Hi, and welcome to Dr. Scott Gray's Redefining Physical Therapy podcast for orthopedic, sport, and manual physical therapists, delivering practical and real-life content and strategies for busy clinicians. Here is your host and expert physical therapist, Dr. Scott Gray.
Hey everyone, this is Dr. Scott Gray, and welcome to the next episode of the Redefining Physical Therapy podcast. And so today I have an awesome guest for you guys. His name is Dr. Greg Jefferson, and he is out of Tampa Bay, Florida. And Dr. Jefferson may be the best manual therapist you probably have never heard of. And so it is an absolute honor to have him on here today. You guys are all going to learn so much from him. Before I introduce Dr. Jefferson, I want to tell you a little bit about him and his clinical practice and what he specializes in. Obviously, he's a manual therapist and orthopedic therapist by trade. He is a fellowship trained through AOMPT, is a manual therapist. He currently practices in Tampa, and he has over 10 to 12 years of experience. So it is with great pleasure and honor to have Dr. Greg Jefferson on the podcast today. So Greg, why don't you tell everyone out there, what kind of got you into physical therapy from the start, and then we'll kind of go ahead and tell our listeners here in a minute about your case.
Yes, so I think I was in about the 10th grade. I was watching a football game, and it was the San Francisco 49ers. One of their football players, and I remember, I think it was Roger Craig, injured his knee. So they interviewed two people during that period, and they were asking them, those two people, roughly what was going on with the athlete. The first was a physician, orthopedic surgeon. He spoke briefly about what was what type of procedure he had performed and what he did and how this athlete may return back to play. The next person they interviewed was a person that had great knowledge in the injury itself, the tissue that was involved, the surgical procedure, and how long it would take this athlete to get back to play. Now that impressed me greatly. So then I asked my high school professor, who at that time, high school teacher at the time, had a PhD in anatomy, and the doctor told me at the time, he's a physical therapist. Really? Because he watched the same game. And so he set me up with a physical therapist in the community, and I followed her for maybe a half a day, and I was sold. And this lady, she had great knowledge in the anatomy, exercise, manipulative techniques. I mean, she was really awesome. We don't keep in touch that much these days, but that impressed me greatly, and that's where I've been since then. Since 10th grade, can you imagine that, knowing what you want to do?
Right. Most people are lucky to get it right at the age of 25,
Yeah, but if you get it, you get it.
Yeah, absolutely. So anyway, Greg is going to be talking about a case of a patient who had a diagnosis of cervical spondylosis, and then he's going to talk about how he then made a differential diagnosis call the referring physician because he saw something, a red flag in the clinic. So Greg, why don't you just go ahead and start from the subjective all the way to the objective in regards to the your case, and then we'll kind of get into some question and answers here.
Yes, so this patient is, like Scott said, cervical spondylosis. This patient is a 78-year-old male referred to the clinic. His chief complaint was localized neck pain, mostly on the left side. He had limitations with looking to the left, looking up, reaching overhead. Didn't have any radicular signs or symptoms. But this patient, he's also very active in the community at home, and this was impairing his daily function. So the doctor referred him over. Now, keep in mind, this patient had a 30-year history of neck pain. It's on and off, again. And then 2 weeks prior to the visit, he may have done something in the yard that increased his symptoms, and he came to the clinic. The doc did an x-ray and found that there was some osteoarthritis, mid-cervical, and also lower cervical. We're talking in C3, C4, down to C6, C7. Now, he didn't even have any ridiculous signs. his tests and measures, when you look at his posture, he had significant forward head posture, decreased cervical lordosis, increased thoracic kyphosis, protracted scapula, scapulas on both sides. His heart rate and blood pressure within normal limits, blood pressure 120 over 70, heart rate roughly around 65 beats per minute. So all of that was taken. This patient had no issues with drop attacks, clumsy gait wasn't there. He didn't have any signs that would make you think he is coming in with an upper neuron problem or vestibular insufficiency. So during the objectives, of course, like we talked about the postural things, but during the objectives, we looked at his mobility assessment. And part of my education was through the University of Augustine and also Maitland trained as well. So we're looking at pain provocation with mobility testing. Also, are those segments restricted? So one of the things we looked at was some active signs and symptoms. Of course, this patient's looking at cervical active range of motion. He had pain with looking to the left, pain with looking up, and also pain with side bending to the left. Getting this patient on the table, mobilizing his upper cervical down to upper thoracic, looking at the unilateral PAs on the left side, he had pain provocation with C3, C4, and also C5, C6, anything in any segment in between. Mid-thoracic, upper thoracic were also hypomobile, very stiff, but no pain with that. So that takes us up to the objective component of that. Any questions regarding that?
So at that case, what are you thinking in regards to, when you see on the referral, spondylosis or OA, what kind of goes in your head? I mean, obviously we know, you know, based off some of the research, you know, some patients will have, you know, spondylosis, but they don't have any pain. So when do you kind of, I guess, what was kind of going through your head at that case?
Right, so the first thing I wanted to clear, are there any other problems that a physical therapist is not equipped to address? So looking at the vestibular basal issue, also looking at upper motor neurons, all of that is clear. So now I'm thinking more facet or facet dysfunction, because he didn't have any ridiculous signs and symptoms. So I'm thinking more unilateral facet dysfunction at that time. And still, during my treatment process, I did that. But that was my my working diagnosis.
Sure.
Now, I the x-rays, I do respect them to the point that that's the patient. That is one portion of the patient coming in. It's a still picture, but it's not a dynamic It doesn't, what's the word I'm looking for? It doesn't do the patient complete justice in a sense, because now I only have a still picture. I need to act the component as well. And so that's why we do those active exams. That's why we do those mobility exams. That's why we do all those other things to get the whole picture of that patient coming through the door. Now, there's one thing I forgot to mention. I usually put patients in categories of, is this patient stiff dominant, pain dominant? Okay, so is he highly irritable or low irritability coming in? Because that will drive also my treatment approach. This patient coming in, he was moderately irritable, but I also put him in a stiff dominant category, because those segments, lower cervical, upper thoracic, very stiff, mid cervical, moderately painful. And so I addressed it that way. I went with the most stiff component first and bridged up to working on to see if that have any effect on minimizing his mid cervical pain and dysfunction. And yes, it worked. And then from there, you start to attack the or address the main comparable signs. You can do it the other way too, but I wanted this patient to feel comfortable with my treatment approach.
So you kind of, just to recap, so you kind of went after the hypomobile segments that were probably causing a lot of the dysfunction.
Yes.
So you kind of indirectly treated that mid-cervical spine by kind of going after the upper thoracic, if I'm hearing that correctly.
Yes, correct. Now, during this process also, because what's going in my mind as I'm treating this patient are those three, the evidence-based, the three pillars of evidence-based practice, you know. Number one, using the most relevant research. Number two, the patient values and the clinical expertise that's involved. What weighed heavily at that time was the patient value. The reason why I'm doing this, because I wanted the patient to feel comfortable with my skill set. And also I'm explaining to the patient, this is why I'm doing this. Because if we can get these stiff segments moving first, it may unload the segments that are painful. So there's a constant conversation with the patient of why you do certain things, because you definitely want them involved. This is their care. If they don't value what you're doing, you know, you can have all the great skill in the world. You're not going to be able to help that patient.
That's such a good point, Greg. I think a lot of times other physios get blinded and they say, oh, what's the research say? But you know, you look at evidence-based practice, right? There's patients' expectations, right, as you kind of alluded to, and clinical expertise, which are, I think, things that we can kind of control more and kind of consider. Yeah, that's a great point.
But those things should be weighed equally. Now, they're equally as important because the way I see it, the way I understand it, that it is the clinical expertise, in a sense, that that is driven the relevant research. So I mean, you have great names out there. I don't want to throw any names out there, but these people, something caused them to think, what if I did this? And a lot of it is their educational background that led them to pursue a certain technique or a certain treatment strategy because they practice that way and because they also trained under certain people who said, hey, look, try this. This may work. Try that. This may work. And that's the whole premise of the fellowship, is being basically put under a spotlight by your mentor to say, what would you do in this situation? Well, I don't know. Let me go back to the basics. And sometimes you always get to the right destination if you're comfortable with the basics.
Yeah, that's such a good point, too. I mean, I think it's good to get all these sexy techniques and that, but a lot of times 90% of your patients will get better if you do the basics, and, you know, and this is with any skill in life, you know, if basketball player, right, you got to learn to dribble before you do a crossover or whatever. And it's all the basics, you know?
Yes, I agree.
So anyway, tell us, you know, so what was the outcome or what kind of other treatments did you go about with this patient in far as the outcome?
Okay. So this patient, how would I address that? Okay, so we'll use the names of the groups that I've trained. So we'll say with Paris approach or Maitland approach or Mulligan approach. This patient, of course, I did some Paris techniques with the patient in prone, some Mulligan techniques with the patient seated, and some Maitland techniques with the patient in prone also. But ultimately, the goal is to improve capsular mobility. So we're using graded techniques. At this time, I didn't do any high velocity techniques, because the patient more likely wasn't as comfortable with those techniques, but he was comfortable with mobilization techniques, you know, low grade techniques. So we did quite a few of those for the first and second visit.
And Greg, are you doing more kind of up glides on that left facet, or how do you go about that when you're treating, say, someone who has DJD of the cervical facets or stiff hypomobility?
Right. So with this patient, because the pain was on the left side, I didn't want to address it right away with the fear of or concern of flaring him up. So I took another indirect approach. Instead of doing a down glide on the left side or up slide on the left side, I did more of a down glide on the right side, still moving the segment, but not to the same degree of intensity. And so as this patient's irritability started to calm down from moderate to low, then there was more a direct technique of doing a down glide mid-cervical on the left. Also an upglide to the mid-cervical on the left. But I'm still keeping in mind that I'm treating both peri- and intra-articular on that side. And so then we move to more Mulligan snags technique with improving left rotation, you know, doing a passive intervertebral mobility test there. And so also doing static stretching techniques too with down glides in a seated position when the patient is ready.
So maybe elaborate on that. What do you mean by static down glides as far as exercise or hands-on? What do you mean by that?
Okay. So if my goal is to improve left rotation, then let's say I block the articular pillar of, we'll say, C5, and then give the patient a left rotation to improve mobility of C4 over C5 and statically hold that within that patient's range. And then I can work my way up and down those segments based on that patient's tolerance to the activity, all while in a seated position. So this gives the patient a little bit more control, but it also puts the patient in a weight-bearing position, which will be a bit more functional for him during his daily activity. And so that the treatments can go back and forth based on the patient's tolerance. Have them on the table supine, have them on the table prone, and then back to a seated position. You can do this back and forth based on the patient's tolerance to that. Now, also keep in mind, you've also increased the vigor of the technique. This is where you really want to have a lot of conversation with the patient. Am I hurting you? Because I always say that so the patient will know, this is your opportunity to tell me. Because the idea of no pain, no gain doesn't seem to cut it. If you're irritating the tissue, you are inflaming the tissue. You're creating problems for the patient. Sure. But you want to make sure that they also remain in control of their treatment sessions each time they come in.
Sure. Now, do you do any sort of, say you get someone who's got, you know, some severe spondylosis of the cervical spine, and as you know, you see it in your, you know, 70 and 80 year old gentlemen and women that come in the clinic. Do you ever do, say, traction on them? What has been your outcome with that? If you're not getting the results that you need with your, you know, your upglides and downglides or PAs?
Yes. So when I think traction, I'm thinking more manual traction, because if I put them on a machine, now I have nothing against traction, but I don't get a chance to talk to them as much. When I have my hands on them, I'm having the conversation. Does this hurt? Does this relieve your symptoms? So what are your symptoms now? Oh, you feel it in the neck. Okay, as I give a little bit more traction, do you still feel it now? So it allows me to have this conversation with the patient. And it's at the same time I am building a greater rapport with the patient, because I just didn't stick the person on a machine and walk away. I am there with them. But from time to time, I've used traction in the past with some good results. But I prefer at this point in my practice to use more manual traction, because it allows me to transition to something else very quickly.
Right, exactly. That's a good point. You can, like you said, symptom reproduction, what alleviates it, what doesn't. You can tweak it a little bit, you know, based off your force or angle. Yeah, that's a good point, Greg. All right, so now, Greg, so overall, I'm assuming this patient got a lot better, or, you know.
Yes, he did. He went back to his daily activity. Really pleasant to, every once in a while, he'll stop by and talk up a storm, but it was good to get him to that point. That's another thing I wanted to lead into. The longer I practice, the more I realize, you know, because the physician that referred the patient to me is a family doctor. He's an osteopath. The more I realize, you know, the family doctor and the physical therapist are very similar in a sense, where we should see this patient on a regular basis after they've been discharged from therapy, there should be a little bit of a checking in every so often to see how this patient is doing. Because with the family doctor, there's always regular checkups. So I like that role. I like that role of the patient coming in every once, just stopping by. Let's see how you're doing. Looking great? Okay, good. You're good to go.
Yeah, that's a good point. I know we've been doing it at our practice is we do 6-month checkups. And so all we say is, you know, just like the dentist, we want to make sure that, you know, your muscles and your bones are moving optimally and there's nothing else going on. So just like you get your teeth cleaned every 6 months, right. You know, we would just schedule them right then and there and they kind of resonate it with because they're used to doing that with the dentist. And then,
right.
You know, you don't need a referral. Obviously, at least here in Florida, you come right in and through direct access and yeah, it's great. It's because you can address something before it becomes more of a bigger cause, but also you can just see how they're doing.
Right.
Yeah, that's great. So, Greg, tell us a little bit then. So, obviously, this patient had forward head posture. Obviously, you want to address the thoracic spine, which I'm sure you do. But what do you do far as your – do you do any deep cervical neck training stuff? Do you – what are your thoughts on that, or even some, yeah, I'll let you kind of take the reins here.
Yes, so early in practice, I'll talk a little bit about my evolution. Early in practice, I did a lot of deep cervical training with the biofeedback unit, and it had its place. Now, the more I practice, now, that same clinician that developed that, I met her years later. Now, in my practice, all of my neck training is either, it's weight-bearing, because those muscles are more active in weight-bearing. Now, I'll do that, don't get me wrong, I will do those deep cervical training exercises with the patient on the table, just so that they can get a feel for, this is what it should feel like. Okay, are you comfortable with that? Yes. Okay. Good. Now we're gonna leave the table. You're standing. You're weight bearing. I want you on your feet as quickly as we can get you there because we need those muscles working again. So we can do those deep cervical retraining either with lifting a weight or carrying a weight or pushing or pulling with the hands on the wall, whatever you at that time feel that it is comfortable. But also in my practice, I've had the ability. The pleasure of working with some of the good physical therapists there in Bonita Springs, where we have this medical exercise therapy. You know, you have the dynamic isometric cervical extension or exercise unit set up on the patient's head, where they're doing dynamic rotation, dynamic cervical extension. So I use that in clinical practice as well. I also use a little bit of Shirley Sarman's quadruped weight bearing with cervical retraction, forward rocking, backward rocking while holding and maintaining cervical retraction or cervical neutral. So I've gone back and forth with that based on the patient's tolerance to those activities.
That's great. Yeah, I know I use the medical exercise equipment in my practice. And for those of you that aren't familiar with that, I'll post a link on the blog where you can follow it up. But yeah, I think even Shirley Sarman's work is great too. You know, even like you said, maintaining kind of that cervical retraction, right? And then getting some movement bottom up or top down through the arms or whatever to kind of...
Correct.
Yeah, I love it. Love it, love it. So Greg, tell us a little bit about, you know, the differential diagnosis that you had made in this case.
Yes, so I saw this patient, this gentleman for a total of 10 visits. 5 visits in, he came in one morning. He didn't seem himself. Usually he comes right in, he starts the conversation, but he was sweating. He looked a little pale. So I sat him down, took his heart rate, blood pressure. Blood pressure was slightly elevated. Heart rate was significantly lower. So his resting heart rate when he first came in was 60 beats, around 60 beats per minute. But when I measured him, it was roughly around 55, 56 beats per minute. It was low, lower than expected. and he complained of abdominal pain. And so it was something that he never felt. He said he felt it when he was driving over. He also had to make frequent trips to the men's room without any relief. So I called this patient's family doctor and recommended that he go see the family doctor. Family doctor evaluated him and found that he was having an issue with diverticulitis. And so they put him in. He also had some cardiac enzyme, elevated cardiac enzyme. So they put him in the hospital for 3 days. Now, 3 days of being on your back can almost undo all the work you've done with this thing. And it nearly did. So when the patient came back, I had to see him for an additional 5 visits. But he was motivated. And so he came back. He did an excellent job. That was a real scare there for a moment. But going back to the basics, so if I didn't have the blood pressure, heart rate, all those readings prior to this incident, I wouldn't have anything to base it on. So it's always going back to the basics. When you're in trouble, go back to the basics. And just realize that, hey, look, I have a team member out there with a little bit more education in this area than I do. I should get him on the phone. And I did. And it helped him out greatly.
Yeah, that's awesome. I think it's such a good point. I think as a physical therapist, especially with us having a lot of direct access now, even, you know, make sure that it's muscle skeletal first, right? And even like you said, get a baseline. You know, you're checking the vitals, you know, day one they come in to see. You might catch someone who's had chronic high blood pressure who, you know, whatever, and they might be close to stroking out and you might save their life. But yeah, that's such a good point. I think it's tough sometimes in a busy clinic, but I think we gotta make it happen, right?
Yes, you have to make it happen because it's our duty.
Right.
As a physical therapist. But also with that, taking this patient's, because he asked me, why are you doing this? I'm just here for therapy. The first time he came in, why are you doing this? I'm just here for therapy. Oh, I'm just establishing a baseline. Now I use that baseline. Now this patient thinks highly of physical therapy because of that. And the doctor that referred him thinks higher physical therapy. You know, I like doing that because it gives us a better vantage point, a little bit more respect for what we do.
Totally. I think, too, it helps establish yourself as the expert, right? And it helps with outcomes because they're just like, whoa, this guy, he knows what he's doing, right? He's gone he's very invasive or very thorough with his exam, right? Like, exactly. I'll always do a neuro exam, even though I don't think there is a neurological condition going on, just because I'm thorough. And the patients respect that. They'll buy in more. So for those of you listening, if you're not doing some of those things, I'd highly recommend it. You'll have better compliance and winning your patients over.
Right. I would agree.
Yep.
I would
agree. So, Greg, obviously you're a very well-trained and astute manual therapist. Let's get into some manual therapy dialogue and talk.
Okay.
So, obviously, you've trained with Maitland. You've trained with Paris. You did some Mulligan stuff. And I think you've even trained with Mr. James Dunning a little bit as far as manipulation.
Yes.
So, maybe kind of highlight, you know, what you learned a little bit from each camp. And obviously, you probably use an eclectic approach, I would imagine. Kind of what you've learned from each camp.
Okay. So with St. Augustine, very good with examination process. They focus heavily on arthrokinematics, biomechanics, patho-anatomic approach, and of course manipulation. And so that was my baseline. That was my base course of study. And from there, I moved to training with Maitland. Maitland is more symptom response, pain provocation, which I don't find that there is a difference in how Paris views things and how Maitland views things completely. I mean, they both are moving in the same direction in a sense where this is what we're looking for when we see the patient. It's always examination. Maitland, the moment the patient comes in, you're examining the patient. With Paris, the moment the patient comes in, you're examining the patient. the evaluation weighted process happens every time the patient comes in, which is great because that keeps you on point with the patient. With Dr. Dunning, excellent manual manipulative technique skill. I mean, there's not enough I can say about his treatment approach when it comes to manipulating the spine. Very smooth techniques, crisp, on point. So I also did some Mulligan, which is also another, his is more mobilization / manipulation with movement. So it's mostly weight bearing. Now the ones I've talked about earlier, St. Augustine, Maitland, they can always be adjusted to weight bearing, but predominantly they're non-weight bearing techniques. You're not limited to that. It can be weight bearing, but Mulligan's is primarily weight bearing techniques. So you could take any technique that you learn from these great programs, and there are many others out there from these programs, and you can modify it to suit your position or the patient's position and to the level and degree you want to affect on that patient when you're doing these techniques. It's not always an all or none. I mean, you go into this with a mindset that it's based on the patient. In your mind, or in my mind, when I'm thinking about this, what is in the best interest of the patient? Can my skill set deliver that? If it can, all right. If not, then I find someone who can, because it always goes back to what is in the best interest of the patient. Should they be in my clinic because I can deliver this technique, or should they be at someone else's clinic who is better at these techniques than I? And I think that's where we probably should have a better dialogue as physical therapists. You know, you have a stroke, Mr. Jones. I am not skilled in that area, but I can find a physical therapist that is very skilled in an area that I can refer you to. But that's where I would go with talking about those different groups.
Yeah, awesome stuff. So Greg, I'd like for you to also kind of talk about, you know, because there's much debate online these days. People say, well, you know, manual therapy doesn't work. You know, obviously you and I are going to disagree with that completely. Kind of maybe talk about, you know, what things you think go wrong with manual therapy, why people say it doesn't work, and kind of, yeah, put your spin on it as far as why you think that, and I'll chime in too a little bit.
Well, I would tell you, if I'm a new grad, or if I've been practicing for 3 years, or, you know, less than 3 years, and I've treated, we'll say, a couple of hundred cases without any good result, then I would say manual therapy doesn't work if I've been trained. But am I being completely honest? Because I've heard and I've been told that it takes some time to develop your hands and skill to deliver technique. Now, I will tell you this story. I was a new grad, and I met a physical therapist that had been practicing for years. This physical therapist would tell me during his prognosis, he would tell the patient, okay, in about 6 visits, I think you're going to be fine. You do well with therapy. Now, I'm saying to myself, you know, how can you do that? I mean, I don't know how can you do that with such a surety of yourself? Now, I didn't have the clinical background that this therapist had. This therapist had been practicing for 25 years, predominantly in manual therapy and manipulative techniques, right? But he knew on the evaluation, he localized the tissue, he localized the patient's problem. He even did a treatment technique to get the patient's pain down 50%. This guy knew what he was doing because he was very confident in his skill set. He had put the time in. So manual therapy techniques work if you practice. That's why I think when people say manual therapy techniques, they don't work. Well, you can probably look at that person and say, how long have you been practicing? Less than 3 years? Yeah, it's probably not going to work because you haven't really been practicing
right.
as much as you need to deliver an effect on that patient. Are you communicating with the patient enough? Are you getting their feedback? Are you just doing a technique hoping it works? It doesn't work that way.
Right. Yeah, that's what I find too. I think, you know, I see a lot of young students or even some clinicians have been practicing for a while. They don't know the biomechanics behind it, what they're actually trying to facilitate. And even they don't know how to stabilize or, you know, how to apply, like, you know, based off the tissue reactivity. You know, you might do grade ones and twos just to get pain so you can reduce it. So then you might have a better outcome with your exercise for that day, right?
Right.
Or even this, especially with the mid-cervical spine, I find a lot of clinicians are, you know, afraid to get in there and really mobilize that facet joint and, you know, really get that down glide. And they just don't get to the end range of where a lot of the magic happens, you know, when they're mobilizing. So, yeah, that's such a good point. So I think there's a lot of people, you know, if you follow online, they're almost kind of treating physical therapy now like personal trainers. Well, let's just come in, we got to load them up and yada, yada. Well, I think that's, pardon my French, bullshit, you know? You know, we didn't go to school for that, eh? And there's something to be said about with the hands-on to restore the normal arthrokinematics, reduce pain, right, to give you that window for a more treatment effect as far as your exercise or whatever you may do that day. But also, I think even, and Greg, maybe you can highlight on this, getting the accurate diagnosis, right?
Right, right. I mean, that's important. Finding which tissues, how Dr. Grimsby would say, which tissues are in lesion,
right.
Or Dr. Parrish would say, which tissues are in lesion. I mean, that even holds true with the exercise you develop, the exercise you prescribe for this patient. If you give them anything, non-prescriptive exercise, if you give them anything, they may not get the results you're looking for. I mean, because now you say, oh, exercise doesn't work. Well, you haven't really targeted the tissue specifically, and you're not going to get the results. Just like the manual techniques, you're not going to get the results you're looking for. And your question was to talk more about the diagnosis.
Yeah, so far as an assessment, right? So I think, like, right, so a lot of people think of manual therapy as kind of more of just a treatment effect, right? But it's also very diagnostic, I think, too. You know, as far as helping discern, is it joint, muscular sometimes? Because sometimes it's not always so clear, you know?
Right, right, right. It's very diagnostic. We can go into history of why PTs were kept out of doing manipulation, but we'll say that for a different time. But we'll talk about Dr. Jewell's work, Gwendolyn Jewell, doing a PA, we'll say central PA over the cervical spine, and then a unilateral PA, pain provocation. Okay, so now you have this patient that comes in. He can't turn to the left. You do have this patient in prone. You do a posterior anterior glide on the mid-cervical, and, oh, that's my pain. That's very diagnostic because you've used two things to determine whether or not this patient, is this problem here? Yes. Now you add that patient's problem specifically, and so now your treatment approach is based on that. Of course, it bridges from there. But it's specifically working on that particular area. Now, you may still have something in mind of is it intra-articular, meaning within the joint, or peri-articular, without the joint. If you do a stretch to the joint and it causes pain, or there's peri-articular. If you do a stretch to the joint and there's no pain, but then you do a PA glide and there's pain, oh, there is intra-articular. So now you've used your manual therapy techniques to differentiate whether it's peri or intra-articular, and your treatment approach will be slightly different. So yes, it's very diagnostic.
Yeah.
So for the listeners, if they have anything, if they have those questions in mind, I would say practice your techniques to the point where you've refined them so well that you're comfortable delivering these treatment strategies to patients. The literature's been quite clear on that there are some diagnostic effects on there. There's some diagnostic indicators whether or not the manual therapy techniques are beneficial. But also the same with exercise, the same with other techniques. But, you know, it just takes a little bit more work than what I think people are willing to do.
Sure.
And it shows in their outcomes.
Right. And I would further that too, your stance on that. I think, yeah, if you're just starting out or you're new to manual therapy, you know, get good at the basics, right? You know, you could, the assessment is the treatment as well. You know, if you're doing a down glide assessment, right? That's the same thing as treatment. So just pick a few things and don't get too fancy, right? Because at the end of the day, it is the basics that will help about 90% of your patients. So that's good. So, Greg, why don't you give our listeners here a clinical pearl that you found, or that you think they could apply in the clinic today with their patients to help them better clinicians?
Okay, okay. I thought about this after we spoke earlier today. The best clinical advice, a clinical pearl that I can give, was given to me. Be more reflective in what you do with a patient. So, let's say, here's an example. I treat this patient. As I walk out the room, I reflect on, could I have done that better? Could I have talked to the patient a little bit more? Could I have engaged them a little bit more? When that patient leaves, could I have done, what could I have done differently that would have got a different, that would have gave me a different outcome? What techniques work best for this patient? What do they prefer? Being more reflective in what you do with each patient helps you gain a little bit more knowledge in that particular group, because not everyone's going to respond the same to techniques. But being more of an active listener as well. I mean, it's no technique, but I think we place a little bit too much emphasis on techniques from time to time. Sometimes just getting back to listening to the patient, because I am told on numerous occasions by physical therapists who've been practicing for a very long time, longer than me, and I like conversing with these guys and ladies, that 80 to 90% of their diagnosis come from subjective information. So now that leaves, what, 15-10% is all physical examination. But even with that, they've already streamlined it to a point where I know what this person's problem is. Now I'm going to use my physical components, the physical component of my evaluation, to narrow down specifically what's involved. Instead of doing so many different types of tests to get to the answer. Now that's the difference between a master clinician and a novice. You have to do all those tests to be able to say, okay, right now I don't necessarily need that one. I can start weaning it down. But that would be my clinical pearl. That helped me greatly. And that information came from Dr. Paris and also my mentor, Eric Douglas, also said the same thing. So I appreciate those two men for that clinical pearl, because it sticks with me each time I see a patient. Can I do something different? What do I need to? Should I ask this patient a different question? How can I ask it? I mean, is she listening to me? How would I know if this patient actually hears what I am saying? You know, without offending the patient, because their experience. They're here for us, or we're there for them. I'm sorry, this is their experience when they come to the clinic.
Yeah, that's such a great clinical pearl. You know, I made that early on mistake of, you know, as a young therapist, you know, you do every test under the book, but then, you know, once you start seeing patients, you start categorizing, and you can kind of weed between the BS of, and when you do take the time to listen to them, they'll tell you what's wrong. Yes, and you just gotta ask the right questions, listen, yes. as Dr. Jefferson said, and then use your exam to help rule in or rule out your diagnoses or your biases. And it goes a long way. That's such a great point, especially for any clinician who's been practicing for 20 plus years. You can't get enough of that. So that's great.
Yes.
So, Greg, I want to thank you for taking the time to educate our listeners and therapists. That was an awesome case. Where can other clinicians get in contact with you? Do you have an email address or that you'd be willing to disclose, or should they go through me?
My email is jeffersondpt ask.gray@yahoo.com. I'll be glad to talk to any clinicians out there.
All right. Well, thanks again, Greg.
All righty, sir. You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to Scott Gray's Redefining Physical Therapy podcast, the number one podcast for orthopedic, sport, and manual physical therapists.